Twitter and Facebook say they are no longer accepting advertising from state-controlled news media. The announcements came just hours after reports that China's largest state-run news agency has been buying ads on Facebook and Twitter that compared protesters in Hong Kong to cockroaches and Islamic State terrorists. For more on this coordinated effort to sway global opinion, let's bring in Sarah Cook. She's a senior analyst at Freedom House, a group that promotes democracy around the world. China, by the way, considers the group a propaganda arm of the U.S. government. She's also director of the China Media Bulletin. Sarah, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
And first, your response to the news that the Chinese government is behind this propaganda campaign on Facebook and Twitter to paint the protesters in Hong Kong as terrorists.
I'm not entirely surprised, because even if you just look at the Twitter accounts or the Facebook pages of both the Chinese language versions, but especially the English language versions of Chinese state media, this is exactly the kind of content that they've been posting organically on their accounts. So then to see that they're using advertising to amplify it or a network of other accounts to amplify it isn't really entirely surprising.
Now, Facebook and Twitter are completely banned in mainland China. So what's the strategy about? What do they gain by targeting the global audience?
Well, something to keep in mind is that it's not always just targeted at the so-called West, the United States, the UK. Actually, if you look at who their followers are, it's very clear that they're actually targeting much of the developing world. Hmm. So it's really people in Indonesia, in Nigeria, in Turkey, in other places around the world where I think there's a sense that they have more likelihood to have an impact. It's easier a bit to muddy the waters, but it's quite important for China and Chinese state media to try to maintain their credibility. And these are places where it's a little easier to believe also some of these kinds of narratives related to protesters being violent or the CIA supposedly behind it.
Well, it seems like the information war that they're waging might be having an impact. Here's some of the protest sound that we heard over the weekend. This is in Toronto when pro-democracy Hong Kong protesters got into a clash with mainland supporters. And those confrontations happened in major Western cities around the world. About 60 million Chinese people live abroad. How receptive is that diaspora to Beijing's influence?
I think it depends, but it is quite susceptible because one of the other things that the Chinese government has really built up over the years has been quite a bit of control and influence over the Chinese diaspora media, particularly television. Chinese state media is watched all over the world. If you look at the markets in the United States, it's really dominant. Chinese people everywhere can watch it. And I used to live in Queens, and I walked into the local Chinese restaurant, and CCTV was on TV. And I was a little bit shocked. I was kind of surprised.
Yeah.
The state broadcaster, yes. So from that perspective, they're very influential. But they're also very influential increasingly because of WeChat, which is a Chinese social media platform that is very popular. It's ubiquitous inside China, and many members of the Chinese diaspora, especially overseas Chinese students, will use that as a primary source of news, even when they're outside China and have access not only to independent English language news reporting, but also independent or critical Chinese news reporting, whether it's from the Chinese version of the New York Times or some of the independent Chinese language media from Hong Kong or from other parts of the Chinese diaspora.
Well,
and so
right.
A lot of these protests have actually been overseas Chinese students who have, you know, absorbed the narrative from the Chinese state media and in general also have a little bit more of a kind of nationalistic leaning. There are many people in the Chinese diaspora who are supportive of the Hong Kong protests too, but sometimes they're also afraid of being so public about it because they have family in China and they're afraid that there's going to be retribution against them there for speaking out.
Well, to that point, does the Chinese government worry that when its citizens go abroad to study or to work in places like the United States or Canada, that they'll be awakened to democratic ideas and freedoms that are enjoyed in those countries?
Absolutely. That's why they take so much effort to influence the media environment outside of China. And in the case of Chinese students and some other populations, there's real efforts by the Chinese consulates to try to maintain control and even really intimidate some of the Chinese student groups at different universities. So they're very much aware and trying to prevent that. And it's partly a lesson from history, because in 1989, when there were mass protests in China, there was a lot of support by overseas Chinese, and it kind of shocked Beijing after the crackdown in the Tiananmen Square massacre. So that was really when they set out to systematically try to regain the upper hand in terms of control over the diaspora and diaspora media outside China.
And how much of this is part of a larger strategy by President Xi, who has said that he wants to unite Chinese people around the world?
Well, this kind of strategy really precedes Xi Jinping, but it certainly is a part of that approach. And this idea that all Chinese people belong to China, no matter where they live, no matter their citizenship, there's definitely this sense that anyone who is really ethnically Chinese should be loyal, not so much to China, but loyal to the Chinese Communist Party. And in some cases, that's part of what really upsets and probably frustrates Xi and the Communist Party in terms of what's happening in Hong Kong, because here you have a lot of ethnic Chinese people saying, look, we don't really want your Communist Party political system. We want an open and democratic and representative political system here. And that goes very much against what the Chinese Communist Party is trying to achieve.
Sarah Cook is senior analyst at Freedom House and director for the China Media Bulletin. Sarah, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
To Washington State, where a summer drought is beginning to have a real impact on communities there, like the town of North Bend, about 30 minutes outside of Seattle. Most development there is on hold until the issue of water is resolved. From member station KUOW, Eilish O'Neill reports.
The population of North Bend has nearly tripled over the last 30 years, and more than eight times as many people now live in the city of Snoqualmie as did in 1990. All those people need water.
It turns out that North Bend, Washington relies on water from one spring and one well.
Nick Bond is the state climatologist.
And they can draw only a certain amount from that.
That's because the spring and well where North Bend gets its water are in the Snoqualmie River watershed. If the river drops below a certain level, the city has to stop using water or replace all the water it takes with water it buys from a different watershed. With this year's drought, the river's already low.
Flows right now on the Snoqualmie are about half of what they usually are for this time of year. Those stream flows are continuing to drop. And anticipate that as we get later into summer that, yeah, there's could be some real problems there.
Bond says climate change will bring more summers like this one, with prolonged droughts. Those will compound the problems North Bend's already having. The city of North Bend and a co-op are the water utilities. The co-op has allocated all its water and can't take on new customers. That's left dozens of projects in the commercial and multifamily zones of the city in the lurch until a water solution can be worked out.
There are some folks that have projects approved in that area, one of which is the 212-unit apartment project.
David Miller's the planning director for the city of North Bend. He says the apartment building couldn't get the water permits it needs to proceed because it's in the co-op's territory.
So they were caught in the middle of it.
Miller says there is plenty of water. It's just a dispute between the city and the co-op. But part of the reason the two water providers can't come to an agreement is they can't agree on how to mitigate their impact on the river. The Snoqualmie River is so shallow right now, you could probably walk across it in this stretch above Snoqualmie Falls. The Snoqualmie tribe has traditionally lived on the river's banks and has a deep cultural attachment to these waters. McKenna Dorman is a tribal member and works on environmental issues for the tribe. She says the river hasn't always been this shallow. As the climate's changing, so's the river.
You have less snowpack coming down. You have less cold water coming down throughout the entire Snoqualmie River. And the rising temperature has had a detrimental effect on these fish.
She means salmon. The Snoqualmie River has runs of chinook, coho, and pinks. The Tulalip tribe is also worried about the salmon because they have a treaty-guaranteed right to fish the Snoqualmie River. Daryl Williams is a Tulalip member who's worked on water issues for decades. He says there's climate change, there's a straightening of the river and the loss of trees along its banks, and then there's the sheer amount of water being taken out of the river.
As we have more people moving into the area, there's more water coming out of our rivers and our groundwater systems that feed the rivers. Somehow we need to get more water back into the river.
Williams says, as far as he's concerned, that doesn't mean all development has to come to an end.
We need to do a better job of growing trees along the river to shade the rivers and streams. Log jams can help store water behind them. We're also looking at some more artificial type things,
like capturing and storing heavy spring flows. North Bend is already taking some of those steps. The city has mandated an 115-foot buffer, requiring landowners to plant more trees and keep houses back from the riverbank. And there's a water conservation bill in front of the city council that proponents say could offset the water needs of all these newcomers. And that could help the longtime residents of the Snoqualmie River, the salmon. For Here and Now, I'm Alicia O'Neill.
A lot of people are weighing in on the firing of Daniel Pantaleo. He's the white officer who placed Eric Garner in a banned chokehold in 2014 and held him in one until Garner was on the ground pleading, "I can't breathe," 11 times. Garner later died. Earlier this month, a judge ruled that Pantaleo should be fired, and that is what New York City Police Commissioner James O'Neill did yesterday. But he had this to say.
I can tell you that had I been in Officer Pantaleo's situation, I may have made similar mistakes. And had I made those mistakes, I would have wished I had used the arrival of backup officers to give the situation more time to make that arrest. And I would have wished that I had released my grip before it became a chokehold.
For some perspective on this, we're joined by Cheryl Dorsey. She's a retired sergeant from the Los Angeles Police Department, and she's author of the autobiography Black and Blue, The Creation of a Social Advocate. Cheryl Dorsey, welcome.
Thank you.
I have so many questions for you. First, I'd like to know your thoughts about the firing of Pantaleo, the timing of it 5 years after the death of Garner, and Commissioner O'Neill's comments implying that Officer Pantaleo's actions were mistakes that he or the other officers could have also made.
Well, you know, here's the deal. There was a lot of what I refer to as code talk and doublespeak by the commissioner, because what he was saying was not so much for the public. He was really speaking directly to his officers. We understand exactly what he meant when he said, had he been in that same position, he probably would have done the same thing. Tactics that officers use that lead up to uses of force, in my opinion, oftentimes are the things that get them into trouble. There's never any exigent circumstance. On the LAPD, I was always taught, take your time. You're not in any hurry. Time is on your side, right? And so those officers certainly could have waited until they had sufficient numbers because of the size of Mr. Garner, if they so desired, rather than have Pantaleo jump in, jump on his back, choke him. Why? Because they wanted to punish Eric Garner, because he wouldn't turn around quick enough, because he was asking questions of them that they didn't want to answer. And so they punished him.
You're a career officer for more than 20 years. I produced this series a few years ago where I talked with a police officer, a prosecutor, a conservative talk show host, and a Black academic. We looked at the Garner video and other police videos, and each person had a different thing that they saw. You talking about O'Neill and what O'Neill said and that he was speaking directly to his officers, I'd like to know from you, how would you have advised officers in this case to handle Garner?
Well, you know, it's very interesting because there was a female supervisor, a sergeant, much like me, a Black woman, that was on scene. And, you know, you would hope in any use of force that there would be somebody in that group of officers who could say, that's enough. Don't hit him anymore. Stop. He's saying he can't breathe in this instance. And the fact that this female sergeant stood by idly and watched these officers use a prohibited chokehold, be excessive in a situation that wasn't warranted, because officers are trained and taught to use only that force necessary to overcome resistance. Mr. Garner was asking a question. And when someone is asking an explanation as to, officer, why are you doing this to me? You don't use the force necessary to overcome that resistance by choking them to death. It's unreasonable.
How do you think Eric Garner's case has changed police departments throughout the nation when it comes to offenses like that? Do you think that there has been any change over the last 5 years?
I don't think the Eric Garner case has changed police departments. Listen, the police departments, you know, the system does what it was designed to do. We only know about it now because 2 weeks after Eric Garner was Mike Brown, and you know everything that's happened since then. And so that didn't happen as an anomaly. It's just that we hadn't seen it. People didn't know that that kind of excessive force went on. We know in our Black community that it goes on because we complained about it, and oftentimes Black folks are foo-fooed away. But once things began to be recorded and memorialized and presented in a way that departments can no longer say that thing didn't happen, they have to at least acknowledge it, while I don't think they've appropriately addressed it.
And you're talking about acknowledging it because we now have video. People have their cameras, their cell phone cameras, and they're able to capture it.
Absolutely. And so now that we're seeing what we see, they tell us, don't believe your lying eyes. And so when I listen to the commissioner speak about his decision, and you see how pained and tortured he was, and when he says that the reason he fired Pantaleo is because he is ineffective as a police officer, that had absolutely nothing to do with the fact that he choked Eric Garner to death. Be clear. When Commissioner O'Neill said Pantaleo is ineffective, the reason Pantaleo is ineffective is because he lied. He lied to internal affairs investigators in the course of that whole investigation when he said he didn't choke him. We knew that he choked him. We saw him choke him. And it wasn't until it went to an independent civilian review board. And once that civilian review board took a look at everything O'Neill knew for the last 5 years, he could no longer pretend that Pantaleo hadn't lied about choking Eric Garner. Because now there's a whole board of civilians that he's not going to be able to keep quiet. And that's what makes Daniel Pantaleo ineffective. Because listen, he wasn't the only person there that used force that day. He may have been the more aggressive officer on scene in that he choked Eric Garner, but there were 6 or 7 other officers standing around. Are they too not ineffective?
And in fact, the Garner family is actually calling now for those other officers to face consequences for their actions that day. You know, we don't hear often from, if at all, officers, former or current officers like you, speaking vocally in this way. What has been the response from your former colleagues and present ones around you speaking out in this way?
When I first started speaking, my colleagues really kind of watched me from afar. They didn't really have too much to say on social media. They didn't really like or acknowledge my comments on Facebook. They just watched. But over time, many of them have become more comfortable in being vocal and prominent in supporting me, because everybody who looks like me, who's been on LAPD or any other department, knows that what I'm saying is absolutely true, because we've all experienced racism and reverse racism, and for females, sexism. We've all experienced it. Why more don't speak out? I don't know.
New York City Police Union President Patrick Lynch spoke out against Pantaleo's firing, and he said, our police officers are in distress, not because they have a difficult job, not because they put themselves in danger, but because they realized they are abandoned. For some communities, this kind of response feels kind of hostile, a doubling down of us versus them mentality, the community versus the police department. What do you think of what Lynch said, and how do you think we can come to this sense of community as police being allies with the community and not adversaries?
Listen, Pat Lynch has always been irresponsible in his rhetoric, and he is a president of a benevolent police officers association, and their job is solely to stand behind the officers, circle the wagon, minimize and mitigate bad behavior. And it absolutely is an adversarial police department versus community. What Pat Lynch has said on yesterday with regards to Eric Garner is akin to a dog whistle to the police officers. He's telling them, you have a choice to make now. In other words, don't do your job. Don't go out there and do proactive police work, because if you do, the same thing that happened to Pantaleo could conceivably happen to you. You'll be punished.
My last question for you. The Garner family says now that Pantaleo has been fired, we know, of course, that he has already said that he is going to appeal to get his job back, but they're pushing for him to be charged criminally as a civilian. What are your thoughts on that?
It's already happened. I mean, that ship has sailed. The case went to a grand jury in Staten Island, and they chose not to indict him. Now, I don't know that you can grand jury shop. I don't think you can do it again, charge him, take, you'd have to get a prosecutor to first, you know, agree to that. And I'm not even sure that that's a thing. So everything that can be done has already been done in this case. The family has received a civil settlement, which de Blasio paid almost immediately after Eric Garner was killed. And I heard him just the other day on TV say that, you know, he did that right away because he didn't want to put the family through much more. Well, he did that right away because he knew Pantaleo messed up. So everything that could be done has been done. 5 years has lapsed. The statute has told with DOJ. They've already said we're not doing anything on the anniversary of the 5 years. No more to be done. He's lost his job. So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that now that Pantaleo has lost his job for lying, that he won't do what Betty Shelby did and Timothy Lohman after he shot and killed Tamir Rice, Betty Shelby after she shot and killed Terrence Crutcher, which is go get a job on another police department.
Cheryl Dorsey, retired sergeant from the Los Angeles Police Department. She's author of Black and Blue, The Creation of a Social Advocate. Thank you so much for joining us, Cheryl.
Thank you for having me.
The night before his first scene with Catherine O'Hara, Dan Levy was a little freaked out.
This is my first time acting since a Lifetime movie that I did with Misha Barton.
The stories behind the celebrities. Every Tuesday on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
What happened to Tumblr? That's what fans of the once popular blogging site are asking after Tumblr sold last week to the parent company of a former rival, WordPress, for as little as $3 million. For many, Tumblr defined what was great about the internet before the explosion of modern social media. Let's bring in our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kara Swisher is editor-at-large for Recode and a columnist for The New York Times. Hi, Kara.
Hi.
So you wrote about Tumblr's evolution in your column, and for those who have never used it or are not familiar with it, what is Tumblr? Or maybe better yet, what was it when it first arrived in 2007?
Well, it's something so common now, but it was the first microblogging site where people could post it. It was a social network in a lot of ways, but it was allowed people to post web pages of things that interested them. And it varied as much as the human race varies. And so there were things like scanwiches, which are scans of sandwiches. There were it would vary. And it would be a lot of sexual stuff because people were using it as a place, you know, as a safe haven to express their sexuality. Where they ran into trouble was that a lot of people used it for porn, to put up porn sites.
In the early days, though, you and many other people really liked it. You say it was the hippest club in town.
Yeah, it was. Absolutely. It was really cool. You know, at the time, you didn't have a lot of choice. You had different companies. I think Digital Cities was one where you could just put up websites. There wasn't anything like it where it was so creative. It seems so common today, but it wasn't then that you were able to put up websites, and it gave you the ability to put up pictures and all kinds of interesting things to use your creativity. So I thought it was one of the more creative spaces.
In 2010, Tumblr surpassed the 1 billionth blog post mark. It was sold to Yahoo in 2013 for more than $1 billion. Last week, it sells for $3 million.
Could be up to 10.
And you mentioned, that it's the pornography on the site was one of the problems. But why such the fall for Tumblr?
Well, it was a lot of things. It wasn't just that. They faced all kinds of product challenges. They, you know, the behemoth that was Facebook and people moving to it. Other companies like Snapchat suddenly arrived, and so did Instagram and things like that. So they were sort of passed innovation-wise by a lot of people. And at the same time, they had this persistent problem with pornography. And as they had corporate owners, and there was not just Yahoo, it moved to AOL, which became Oath, which was owned by Verizon. It just went on and on. And so at one point, finally, Verizon banned the pornography, and it really, you know, it hadn't been doing enough innovation so that it could have other, you know, other strengths. And so that's what happened to it.
The decline of Tumblr, what does it say about where we are today as an internet culture?
Well, lots of companies come and go on the internet. So, you know, I think the issue was the price, the ridiculous price that it garnered for almost no business plan. It didn't have advertising to speak of. And it was the value destruction by the CEO, Marissa Mayer of Yahoo, for paying that much. And for the venture capitalists sort of pumping it up. Now, that's their job to do that. It was never worth what it was worth. So it is a cautionary tale for some companies today. You know, you can look at a bunch of them, like WeWork's about to go public. You know, it's trading at 46 times earnings and in a real estate era and pretending to be a tech company. You can look at all these companies that were overvalued over time. And I think that's really where the problem lies, is that they were not as big as people valued them at.
That's Kara Swisher, editor at large for Recode and columnist at The New York Times. Thanks for your time.
All right. Thank you.
The White House is dismissing reports that it is considering a temporary payroll tax cut as part of a strategy to cushion a potential economic slowdown. A White House official told NPR that while the administration is always studying tax cuts, the payroll tax is not specifically under review. But the reports could signal that President Trump's top economic advisors are concerned about a possible recession, even as Trump and other senior officials continue to defend the strength of the economy. So with the attention on the payroll tax, let's find out a little more about it. And joining us to talk about all of this is NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Tanya. Good to be with you.
Yes. So people might have a vague understanding, but for those who don't know, what exactly is the payroll tax?
This is a broad-based tax that's paid by just about anyone who gets a paycheck. Even people who maybe don't make enough money to have a liability for the federal income tax still pay the payroll tax. It's 12.4% that goes to fund Social Security and 2.9% that goes to fund Medicare. Now, typically, your employer pays half of that and the employee pays half. The employee's portion is what you see as FICA on a pay stub, if you still get an old-fashioned pay stub.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if the payroll tax cut were cut, if the payroll tax were cut, the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget says the U.S. Treasury could lose between $70 and $75 billion in annual revenue for each percentage point the payroll tax is reduced. Explain how this could impact the U.S. economy.
Well, it would obviously widen the federal deficit, which is already more than $1 trillion a year. Another way to look at it, though, is that $70 to $75 billion that would be left in workers' paychecks for every 1% point that's cut off the payroll tax. That's additional money that presumably could be pumped into the economy if consumers went out and spent that. The thing is, to the extent that there is weakness in the U.S. economy right now, it's not coming from the consumer side. Consumers are spending at a pretty healthy clip. It's really businesses that are dialing back their spending, and that's one reason we are seeing some slowdown in economic growth. It's possible that consumers could make that up if you left a little more money in their wallet, but not necessarily. Some of them might just decide to save that money, and then in that case, it wouldn't have much impact on the economy.
The payroll tax was previously cut 8 years ago in 2011 during the Obama administration, and that revenue was redirected to Social Security programs. But the cut did add to the deficit. Is there bipartisan support for a similar measure now?
It's hard to say if there's bipartisan support. It would take an act of Congress to do this, and that's what happened back in 2011 when lawmakers approved a payroll tax holiday. And you're right. What they did is they took money from the general fund to backfill the Social Security Trust Fund. So even though people's payroll taxes, which ordinarily help fund Social Security, were not going into that fund, other money was. So Social Security was sort of held harmless and the general fund took the hit. That was justified at the time because we were still slowly making our way out of the deepest recession since the Great Depression. At this point, we're in a situation where the economy, by most indications, is still relatively strong. We have unemployment at a level that we haven't barely seen in 50 years. So it's a little hard to say why you would want to take this kind of drastic remedial action now. But it's something lawmakers might decide they wanted to do if we saw conditions get worse.
Trump has accused the Federal Reserve of working against him. What is the Fed's role in all of this?
The Fed has become kind of a scapegoat for the president and a whipping boy. He wants to see more aggressive interest rate cuts by the Fed. Again, that's the kind of thing you'd typically see when an economy is really in trouble, even as the president and those around him continue to say the U.S. economy is in good shape.
That's NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley. Thank you so much, Scott.
You're welcome.
Well, school starts this week for many kids across the country, and school means a lot of things. Fun for many, but a nightmare for others. Bad PE classes can not only be a drag, but as a recent study shows, they are also linked to teenagers being less physically active as adults. So there's actually a lot riding on physical education in schools. Alan Yu of WHYY's The Pulse reports that some teachers are trying to make gym a lot better.
When Aisha Sultan was in school, she hated gym class, and she particularly disliked running outside.
Because it was such a forced activity, and sometimes we had to do it as punishment. If somebody had done something wrong or the teacher was just like in a bad mood, we would be out there running laps.
Outside, in the heat, in Texas.
I was not particularly coordinated, so I was never good at any sports, and it led me to believe that I was not athletic and terrible at physical activity in general.
She's now a columnist at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. In 2014, almost 20 years after her last gym class, she did what she hated in school. She ran outside.
I was able to run half marathons and I ran a marathon. But you would never have known that if you had seen me in my misery in gym class.
Sultan stayed physically active despite her negative experience of gym class, but the research shows not everyone does that. A study published in the Translational Journal of the American College of Sports Medicine surveyed more than 1,000 people across the U.S., and researchers found that bad memories of gym class, especially memories of not being chosen first for teams, could be linked to being less physically active as adults. In other words, the effects of gym class stay with you.
Behind the white line. When everybody...
I'm standing safely to the side of a dodgeball game at Constitution High School in Philadelphia. The students hurl balls at each other hard and fast. They jump, sidestep, and bounce on their feet the whole time to avoid getting hit. The players are very into this.
Most people say it's not their favorite subject, but it's definitely mine. Definitely enjoy it.
Tymir Felton is a senior. He's tall, fast, and if you're playing dodgeball, you want him on your team.
I'm kind of like an exercise freak, like staying fit, you know, staying in shape. But gym is how I do that when I don't get a chance to work out.
He plays football, basketball, volleyball, runs track and cross country. And that's the issue many critics of physical education class point to. Class is great if you're already fit, but not everyone starts out that way. And if a PE class just reinforces existing differences, the athletic kids get better and everyone else is embarrassed or miserable. Robert Moore, the PE teacher at Constitution High School, knows this. So sometimes he lets the students choose what they want, as long as they fulfill the goal of the class.
Sometimes we're doing our cardio day, we do steps. We do the steps up from the basement to the sixth floor, up and down for 15 minutes. Some kids could be walking, doing stairs, doing cardio, jumping rope. As long as you're doing something active, you get an A for the day.
And he's open to taking a back seat and letting a student lead the class.
I have a girl in one of my classes, she's really into yoga, so we like co-instruct classes sometimes. I've taken yoga a few times, I'm not terrible at it, but she has all the stretches and all the poses, and I let her kind of dictate, and then I just follow along as the teacher, like telling kids, you know, making sure the kids are doing it.
For more, that's the point of gym class.
Trying to get them more active is the idea, and trying to get kids who do lead an active lifestyle, to find things that they continue to do and have fun doing into college and beyond.
PE teachers nationwide are trying to pull off this reinvention of gym class. Michelle Carter is a senior program manager at Shape America, a professional group for health and PE teachers. She says the trope of a drill sergeant type PE teacher comes up often in TV shows and movies, and that's an example of what not to do.
That's old school PE that we are really trying really hard to change.
There are no federally mandated standards for PE class, but Carter says most states adopt the standards from her organization or use something that's very similar. She says her group wants PE teachers to design classes so students can learn at their level. Maybe the star basketball players can play basketball, while the kids who need to learn simply how to pass and catch a ball can also do that. Also, Carter says students should not have to stress about getting picked for teams and where they stand in the social hierarchy.
Find someone who is wearing the same color shirt as you, or find someone whose birthday is in the same month. Find someone whose name starts with the same letter. So it's not friends trying to get with friends or people feeling left out, but it's something that's more random and allows for different people to work together.
She says the whole point is for students to learn skills, running, jumping, throwing, catching, so they can find a physical activity that they like and will do to stay active as adults. For Here and Now, I'm Alan Yu.
On August 20th, which means there's still officially a few precious days of summer left on the calendar, and Here and Now, resident chef Kathy Gunst is here to remind us that corn is still in season. Kathy, hi.
It's very much in season. I get so melancholy when people talk about the end of summer.
So no,
it's
I.
just August. It's just sad, but it's getting darker earlier. Yeah. Okay, corn, focus, right? It's one of my symbols of summer. It's all the sweetness of summer in one food for me. It is so versatile and adaptable, not to mention that it's eaten all over the world. And I actually brought you three dishes today that are from very different places with very different flavor profiles.
What's the first one?
The first one is a corn, tomato, and basil tart. So this is just such beautiful summer eating.
It's and you're obvious. Eating this in the studio.
Yes, welcome, Tanya. I'm so happy I'm feeding you for the first time.
Yes.
It's not like this every day, however. So I made a pastry, but you can buy a pre-made one. I understand people don't want to be making pastry in the dog days of August. This pastry included fresh thyme and rosemary. And then the filling is a caramelized onion, salt, pepper, more thyme and rosemary, and then lots of fresh sweet corn cut right off the cob.
It's delicious. And it's also, I mean, it's just incredibly flavorful. We'll have all the recipes as we always do at hereandnow.org. But Kathy, what about this second one? This looks like a curry.
It is a curry. And these are kind of flavors from India. There's beautiful turmeric, which really matches the color of fresh corn. I just wanted to say for a minute, I talked about cutting the kernels off the cob.
Yeah.
A lot of people are scared of doing that. It is extremely simple. You shuck the corn, you take the whole cob and put it in a large bowl. You very carefully take a sharp knife in your hand and you just scrape down the cob all around.
You're
it.
Saying it's that easy?
I'm saying it's not. I'm not. I.
You'll, it is.
I
easy.
Don't lie. It is so easy. But one more trick is, turn your knife around and use the blunt side and scrape down, and this milk, corn milk it's called, comes off it, and most people waste it.
You know, I have my kids. I don't have them use the knife, but I have them. They like to go on the deck and rip the husk and the silk off.
Yes.
And so that's one way to divide the labor in the kitchen.
Absolutely. But the reason I love this curry is that it uses corn in a really interesting way. So you shuck the corn, right? You scrape the kernels off, and then you throw the cobs away. But wait, no. We make a corn stock, which is way simpler than it sounds. You put it in a pot, all the corn cobs, add a little bit of water, maybe an onion, salt, pepper, maybe nothing. Just let that boil while you're caramelizing the onions for this curry, and you get this sweet, beautiful corn stock, which you can freeze and use all winter. So this curry uses the corn stock, coconut milk, fresh ginger, turmeric, and loads of fresh sweet corn.
It's delicious.
Isn't
it's delicious.
Nice? And it's filling and sort of light all at the same time.
It's light as well.
Time.
Before we get to the third dish, I want to ask you about the types of corn that we can get during this time of year. I am a yellow corn girl.
All right.
But I can never find it. I'm always finding the white corn everywhere. Really? Is there a particular region, area?
There is. And I wish that I knew more about that. I got to get back to you on that. Because the names of sweet corn are so evocative. They're almost poetic. There's honey and cream. Butter and sugar is what they grow in New England a lot of. There's candy corn. There's even a corn called How Sweet It Is.
You brought us an ear of corn.
I did, and I'll tell you why. Not that you can rip it apart and eat it raw on air, but I want you to feel the weight of it. You know how when you go to buy corn and you see all these people ripping the husks off?
Yep.
That is not cool. Okay, let me just say, you're not supposed to do that.
Oh, at the store.
What do you mean? At the store.
Yeah, at the store. You know, like they peek, you rip a piece
off. Oh, they peek to see if it's a good corn or not?
What happens with corn is the minute it's picked, the sugars convert to starch. And if you start ripping the husk off, it starts drying out even faster. So what do you do?
Sorry, I'm
guilty
of that.
Are you one of those people,
Peter? Yeah, so how do you check?
Okay, feel how heavy that is, the weight of the corn. Now, just use your hands and literally feel the corn. Are there any gaps? Do you feel any like sort of empty spots which would indicate worms or that the rows aren't full? When it's heavy in your hand, that's a good sign. Also, the husks are green. They're not dried out. The silk is kind of glossy. These are ways, I mean, the best way to do it is to buy it from a trusted farmer who picks it that morning, as I said, because it's really good. Just for a short while.
Okay, before we leave you, tell us about this third dish.
So this dish I really love because it uses corn in two ways as well. I grill corn. I shuck it. I brush it with olive oil and salt and pepper, throw it on a hot grill. And then I cut the kernels off. And then I make a taco by mixing it with lime juice and cooked chicken. If you're a vegetarian, just get rid of the chicken. And then I use these corn tortillas that are actually made in New Hampshire called Vita tortillas that have a really deep corn flavor, locally sourced corn. You want to look for a corn tortilla that's got whole grains.
Real quick, when you put the corn cobs on the grill, do you take the husk off or you just throw it right on the
floor? Yes, you take the husk off. You want the corn to blister and get blackened, and you'll see in your taco the grill marks. It adds a nice smokiness.
Here and Now, delicious. Resident chef, chef, as always, the recipes are at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much parting gift to summer.
Yes, thank you, Kathy.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.